I agreed to that, and in hindsight, it was a mistake. Richard Branson would often stick his head around the studio door and go, do you think we'll ever get our own radio station one day? So I'm sitting in Michael Caine's flat in Chelsea. He's on the phone to the radio authority.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. John Revel.
So I was born in Peckham in South London on a council estate. So it would be fair to say it wasn't a privileged upbringing. Brother and a sister. My dad was a chauffeur. My mum worked in a canteen at a local factory. Went to a local comprehensive school, which was pretty tough, you know, because, you know, South London's a pretty tough and rough area. From a very early age, I started listening to the radio. Bit of Luxembourg, but mainly Radio 1, which was in medium wave back in those days. On a little tranny up in my bedroom. It would be Stuart Henry on a Saturday morning.
With a time exactly 15 minutes to 12, the Storms.
And I had not a very good hi-fi. It's a Fidelity, I remember it. Plasticky fronted speakers. And it was a bit rubbish, really. And I convinced my dad to buy me something better. And he didn't have much money, and I guess he bought it on credit for me. And I remember it really well. It was a Garrard SP25 Mark II turntable. Sansui receiver, so it had the amplifier and tuner built in and a pair of speakers. So I got all this home and I connected it all up and I had this weird aerial, this copper thing, T-shape. I had no idea what that was for, but anyway, I plugged it in. Of course, it was the FM stereo aerial that you had to connect. So I turned it on and I put it onto FM. I didn't really know what FM was. Tweaking along the dial and then suddenly, bam! There was Capital Radio in this amazing stereo coming through the speakers, and I thought, my God, what's that? That's amazing. Isn't it good to know Capital? And it never went back to medium wave after that, never went back to Radio 1, just stayed with Capital. You know, there was the great Roger Scott on Drive Time, Graham Dean on Breakfast, Kenny Everett on a Saturday afternoon, just genius. So that was really the start of my real interest in radio.
And here's one that started right here on the People's Choice a few weeks ago. Look what a smash it is. Shirley and Company and Shame, Shame, Shame.
I left school at 16 and I went to technical college and I started my apprenticeship in carpentry and joinery. And I worked at a joiner shop in the Old Kent Road. The irony of that was that when I first started working there, they had just started renovation work on All Souls Church at Langham Place, right next door to the BBC. And occasionally they would allow me up onto site. And it was right next door to Egerton House, where Radio 1 would broadcast from. All the Radio 1 DJs would be walking past. Diddy David Hamilton, Stupot.
Hello, darling.
BLT. Oops. So, you know, they were friendly and waved and smiled and all of this. And I never thought in a million years that I would end up actually walking through the doors of Egerton House at some stage and end up working there. It's the most Radio 1. So after I finished my apprenticeship, I thought, you know, I don't really want to do this. Wouldn't it be great if I could work in radio? And how would I get to work in radio? And I thought, it's going to be impossible because I don't have a very good voice. I have quite a strong London accent. You know, accents weren't really accepted back in those days. And a good friend of mine, Joe, we decided that we would go off hitchhiking to France, which was quite an adventure. And then we ended up in the south of France. And this was back in the day when you could go on holiday for £16 for 2 weeks to the south of France. Horrendous 24-hour journey on a coach. And you would get to this campsite and you'd stay in a tent. But actually, the French campsites were lovely. And they had a bar and they had a DJ. And I managed to wangle my way in, but to do some DJing. There was a company called Riviera Holidays who were from Leeds. And they said, oh, we're moving to the other end of France next year, to the Cap d'Agde, and we're going to take over this whole site. And I said to them, does it have a bar? And they went, yeah, we've got a big bar. And I said, we should have a DJ, and it should be me. So we came back to England, and I went to Roger Squire's disco shop, which was up in North London, and we bought all the gear. And I remember Roger Squires, because they also had a radio studio where you could go and make demo tapes. So coming from Peckham, having nothing really, here I am in the south of France, in a bar, having a hoot. And we had a cabaret with a band and a singer and a comedian, and I was the compere. So I then met my first wife there, and she was from Yorkshire. And when we come back in the winter, I would go and live in Harrogate. And I got introduced to a guy that ran a mobile disco business, a guy called Rob Witter. And he had half a dozen DJs working for him, and he had it all sewn up, the whole of North Yorkshire. He had all the big gigs, he would do all the universities, Leeds University, he had all the young farmers associations tied up, he had all the big hotels tied up. I would just have to turn up, do the gig. Brilliant. So I loved this, so I was having a great time.
My name's David Farwig, and this is the mid-morning programme on your brand new local radio station, BBC Radio York.
At that point, I contacted BBC Radio York, and I managed to get along there and do a bit of the ubiquitous tea making, answering phones, chopping gash tape together, trying to salvage all of this. This would be early 80s. And I did go out and do a little bit of remote stuff occasionally. They would let me out with a ewer with somebody, although I didn't appear on it. I would just go and record the interview with somebody and then go back and have a go at editing it. And of course, that was in the day when the BBC had those really weird faders that you opened them towards you. And that was the time I thought, yeah, I really want to work in radio. I think I need to go back to London. I think you need to be in London. But the problem being was you had Capital and LBC. That was pretty much it for commercial radio. You had BBC Radio London, and then you had the main BBC stations. And I thought, this is a closed shop. There's no way that I'm going to be able to get into radio. You know, no way. We came back down to London. My wife, she was then my wife, Debbie was then my wife. We used to go up into town, and she would go shopping into Topshop. And they had Radio Topshop. And I used to go over there, and I thought, this is great. And I used to look through the glass, and there would be the DJs there. Clive Warren came from Topshop. Gary King came from Radio Top Shop.
Well, a special good morning to those of you who are bringing the paper round and the milk round. We couldn't do without you. It's 18 past six if you're looking at the clock.
Then I had this brainwave, and I wrote to Richard Branson, and I said, "Dear Richard, why don't you have an in-store radio station at the Virgin Megastore?" And I get a letter back with the Virgin logo in blue as it was then. And I opened it up, and it was from a guy called Johnny Fewins, who was the managing director of Virgin Retail. "Dear John, Richard has passed on your letter to us. We think it's a really interesting idea. By the way, your timing is perfect because we're about to refurbish the Megastore and we're going to extend it, and it will be the biggest record store in the whole of Europe." So I go and meet with them, and I put together a little presentation. No idea what I'm doing, but I'm winging it. And they go, "Yeah, this is what we want, and we'd like you to do it." So I start, and we build a little studio, and I go about hiring disc jockeys. Now, because this is before the internet, so how do you go about hiring DJs? So I put an ad in a couple of the music papers, and I was getting quite a few phone calls. And the first person to turn up was a guy called Nick Piercy. Now, Nick was already working in radio, but he was resting. So he was looking for a gig to fill in before he got his next proper radio gig. Then I hired Mitch Johnson. He turned up. Then Dave Sander. Then Paul Coit. And then Nick Abbott.
"Dennis, you still there?"
"Yeah."
"Go away."
Because just across the road from the Megastore, there was the YMCA. And the YMCA had its own in-house radio station. And Nick Abbott was a presenter on that. And I got introduced to Nick. So Virgin FM, as it was known as, the in-store radio station, it became a brilliant breeding ground for all that talent, because they all went into radio and all made really good careers in radio. And Richard Branson would often stick his head around the studio door and go, "This is great. You know, do you think we'll ever get our own radio station one day?" And I said, "Well, that would be amazing, Richard, wouldn't it, if we ever did?" So whilst I was there at Virgin, I was introduced to David Campbell. And David Campbell was running Rush's, which was a post-production facility house in Soho, which was owned by Virgin. really nice guy, and you know, we kept in touch, and we'd go out and go for a drink or go for dinner and stuff. And one day David said to me, Virgin are involved in this thing called Radio Radio, and it's being run by a guy called Rob Jones. Or I said, I've heard of Rob Jones, the DJ that used to be on Luxembourg. He said, yeah, that's the guy.
Rob Jones, it's my eyes, let's fly away. Tell you what, I have a feeling it's going to be one of those Tuesday evenings.
And he said, he's putting together this idea for like a syndicated station. So I go and meet Rob Jones. And Rob's great, isn't he? A little firecracker, full of enthusiasm. And he said, yeah, I've got this idea. And basically what I'm going to do is offer a service where all the local commercial radio stations can have big name presenters that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to afford. And we'll give them the programming for free. And we're going to syndicate it via satellite to the stations. And they just take it and they put it out. We take the advertising revenue. They get a big name presenter. So I went away and made a little demo tape of some production stuff and gave it to him. And he went, yeah, I like this. So he gave me a job. And you have to take your hat off to Rob Jones, because he did manage to convince pretty much all the local commercial radio stations. And you can imagine the politics that were involved in trying to do that, to take this service. And it was going to be called the Superstation. So that would be the generic on-air name for this. And he'd signed up Jonathan Ross, Ruby Wax.
Oh my God, oh my God, I'm so... Oh, sorry, that just went right through my pelvis.
Sorry. Diana Luke, Steve Davis, the snooker player, Johnny Walker.
I've just taken the broadcasting breathalyzer and failed.
Get another DJ in immediately.
Well, hello, good evening. It's Johnny Walker back in the night. Hey, listen, this is history in the making going on here. Are you aware of this? Have all the anoraks got plenty of blank tape? Are we rolling here? Testing, are we all right for level?
So I got a job as a producer. So I turn up and there's Rob Jones, who was running the show. Andy was head of programs. A really lovely man who went on to do massive things at Disney. There was a girl called Carol McGiffin, who was the traffic manager. And that's traffic as in ad scheduling. And she was a hoot. She was larger than life character. And I always thought she was destined for something. And of course, that was to be borne out. When I met Johnny Walker, again, the irony of that, I used to listen to Johnny on Radio 1 at lunchtime. You know, I used to come home from school and there was Johnny doing his lunchtime show on Radio 1. And there I am in the same room as Johnny Walker. You know, Johnny was quite tough on the music. You know, that's the one thing. You know, there'd be other, you know, somebody like a Jonathan Ross, you know, weren't overly fast when you were putting the music together. But with Johnny, you know, you had to be on it because he wouldn't let you off the hook on anything. Further down the line, I realised, you know, how difficult some big name presenters can be. We were going to broadcast out of BFBS Studios in Paddington. But before we got on the air, Andy Bird said to me, I've got a friend of mine's going to come down. He's coming down. He used to be at Piccadilly. He's going to come down and work with us as a producer. And you can show him the ropes and, you know, get it going. So one day I'm in the office and I'm putting together a stand for a Revox tape machine. So I'm bolting this thing together. And suddenly the door flies open and standing in the doorway was this really tall guy in a leather jerkin, these long leather jerkin sleeveless things, this shock of red hair. And these big glasses. And he went, John, I'm Chris. I've been told that I've got to come and work with you. So I said, come and help me put this stand together. So he was straight into it. And of course, this is Chris Evans. So we put this stand together and we bolt a Revox onto it, the B77. And I said to him, we'll laugh about this one day, Chris.
We got a message in. I got to read this one out. This just makes me laugh. We got a message in from Rob, and he says, this is something I really must share with you about tomorrow. And this
I was producing Diana Luke. Chris was producing Johnny Walker, sending these programs out around the country from 10 o'clock in the evening. I was producing Steve Davis, who randomly has this huge collection of imported soul music from America. He's an authority on soul music, and he was actually quite interested in real life. Steve, he's a hoot.
Beaming live from the Starship Voyager, 23,000 miles above the planet Earth, This is the Superstation.
And then one day Johnny Walker said to us, keep this to yourself, he said, but I'm leaving. BBC Radio London has got a new boss and it's going to change and it's going to be called Greater London Radio. They're looking for producers and you guys should go and have a conversation with them. And he said, here's the number, it's a guy called Trevor Dan. So go and see Trevor. We have a very nice chat about music. And he played me the new jingle package. And he said, look, I'd love to hire you. So I need music producers. And this, of course, was pre-Selector days. So all the shows would be built by hand. Timing them all, doing all the PRS returns. And also to deal with needle time restrictions. Because the BBC had this ridiculous needle time restriction, which meant you were only allowed to play a certain amount of music per day. So Trevor said to me, look, this being the BBC, you've got to go through the BBC formal application process and you have to go and do a BBC board. He said, but don't worry about that. He said, because I really want you. And he had a similar conversation with Chris. So the day of my BBC board, I go in, I've got my tie on and stuff, and I walk into this office and there's Matthew Bannister sitting there. I think it was somebody from HR, there was somebody else from news, and there's Trevor. And I was hopeless. I was useless because Matthew's firing all these questions about news and talk and what if there was a bomb went off in Oxford Street, what would you do? And I didn't know. Anyway, I finished the board and I go and I walk out of there and I think that was just a disaster and I haven't got this. So I go back to BFBS in the evening, see Chris. He goes, how did it go? I said, it was terrible. I said, I cocked it up. I said, but look, they're going to ask you these questions and these are the answers you've got to give. And I said to him, have you got a tie? He said, no, I haven't. So I took my tie off and I said, well, put that on as well, because it's the BBC. So Chris goes in the next day for his board. And of course, he storms it. You know, every question that Matthew fires at him, he's got the answer for it. He's coming back. So he absolutely kills them dead. And as he gets up to leave, Matthew Bannister says to him, just one more question, Chris. He said, yes. He said, is that John Revell's tie you've got on there? So Trevor Dan phones me up and says, it was terrible and I can't give you a job, but we're going to give Chris a job. So, and I said, look, fair enough. You know, it wasn't what I was expecting. You know, I really am a music producer. I'm not news or speech. So Chris gets this gig. And then 2 weeks later, Trevor phones me up. He said, although you did the worst board in the history of the BBC, I'm absolutely desperate and I need a music producer. So we're going to give you the job. You know, Trevor always knows how to make you feel good about yourself. So anyway, I get the gig as well. And Chris and I go to GLR before it started. You know, I'm a part of that startup phase and when they were just running a couple of weeks of music tapes, which I was putting a lot of those music tapes together, basically.
Interruptions to the music will then be performed by a host of celebrities and stars, and also appearing will be Nick Huhi, Abbott, Emma, Oh My God, Freud, Johnny Who Him, Walker, Timbo the Bimbo, and Tommy, No Seriously, Vance.
And what a place GLR turned out to be. And Nick Abbott ended up doing the breakfast show to start it off, which was nice. And I got given the job of producing Drive Time, which was Tommy Vance. Tommy was such a sweetheart. He'd come in the afternoon and he'd always have a big cigar and he'd go, right, Rev, where's the music? And he'd go through the running order for that day. And one day I went into Trevor and I said to him, there's a guy on TV in London on a Friday evening, early evening, called Danny Baker. And I said, I think he could be interesting. And he said, well, it's really funny you should say that. He said, I've got a letter here from his agent, because this is all pre-email. So he said, why don't I get him in and you do a pilot with him? Danny comes to the station and I meet him in reception, NME under his arm, with a couple of drinks, and he's firing off like a machine gun, as he does. So we go down in, they had a big studio down in the basement at GLR. So I get a reel of tape out, so it's all quarter inch tape. 10-inch spool at 7.5 IPS, you get an hour. Two of these later, and Danny's still going, you know, not even drawing breath. I said to him, look, I think we've got enough, Dan. And I spend the next 2 hours here chopping this quarter inch tape. So I chop this down into a 10-minute pilot and I leave it on Trevor's desk. And I see Trevor the next day and he said, what do you think? I said, well, I think he's amazing. I said, but he's going to be a handful.
You're through to the GLR birthday challenge. Hello, who's this?
Hello, Danny.
Who's that?
It's Martin from Blackford.
Martin, when's your birthday?
September the 26th.
They gave him a show on the weekend. And Chris was the producer on that show. And Chris had his own show, because what had happened was Radio 1 had been advertising for producers, and Chris had applied and got the job. But Matthew didn't want to lose him. So Matthew Bannister said to him, look, what will it take for you to stay? So Chris said, I want my own show. So they gave him an evening show. And then there was a gap in the schedules came up on Saturday morning after Danny for Chris to do a show. So I said to Chris, look, well, why don't we get people to come in? Be like round at Chris's, as if it's round at your house. So that became probably one of the greatest bit of radios, through that decade, because he was on fire.
Do you remember Mark Jeffries and his famous animal impressions? Well, he's here again for the final time. Mark Jeffries and his famous animal impressions.
Morning, Chris.
Morning, Mark. How are you?
Very well. How
As
are
the
you?
Station oh, started to grow, I think you could really identify with a GLR listener. I think they really appreciated some of the real creativity that was coming out of that radio station. I'm not sure if a lot of the senior BBC management agreed with it. Matthew Bannister did an amazing job at fighting his corner, because him and Trevor truly believed in what they were doing and giving platforms to great talent. So people like Chris Morris, you know, for Chris to get a platform would have been really difficult.
Chris Morris, Great London Radio at the time. And what's happening? Today's gash, apart from anything else, stunning revelations in the news, a plan that the British Army is to be replaced with a mirror.
And not long after that, Virgin had just recently won the AM national licence. And we were talking about that. And they said, you should go and run that. You should be the programme director there. And I said, no, I get the experience for that. And I said, I'm sure they're already on with it. And I went away and I started thinking about it. And I thought, well, this is quite interesting. Who do I know? I'll phone David Campbell up. He'll know what's going on. So I phone Rushes and I speak to his PA. And she said, oh, no, David's away on holiday for 2 weeks. He's in America. She said, well, I've got the fax number of the hotel that you're staying at. Remember, this was pre-email, pre-mobile phones. So I write him a fax saying, you may be aware that Virgin have won the AM licence. You should be the managing director and I should be the programme director. About 3 days later, I get a fax back from David, who's still on holiday. Said, well, yeah, I've heard all about this. This is really interesting. He said, but I think they might be on with it. But let me get back from holiday and I'll have a chat with Robert Devereux. So Robert Devereux is Branson's brother-in-law and was sitting on the board of Virgin Radio. David phones me up and says, right, I've spoken with Devereux, but they're already on with it. They've got a managing director. It's a guy called John Almanier. They've got a program director. It's a guy called Andrew Marshall. And they're on with it. He said, but let me see what I can do. He then calls me up a week later and says, I've had a conversation with them. The board aren't very happy with the way it's progressing. This thing's going to go on the air in about 4 or 5 months' time. They're going to run it out of a radio station in Woking. He said, but leave it with me. So I don't hear anything more from David. I go on holiday, come back from holiday. David Campbell is sitting outside my house in his car. He said, where have you been? He said, I've been trying to get hold of you. Remember, no mobile phones. And he said, well, I've done it. The coup de grace. He said, we're in. We're going in to run the radio station. I didn't quite know what to say. I was absolutely flabbergasted and petrified. In between that period, I'd introduced Richard Skinner into the mix. Richard had been a presenter at GLR. And a great, as we know, a great music presenter and a real authority on music.
John in Hazelmere wanted to know how much it costs to run GLR.
And I'd introduced him to David. We'd had lunch. David said to me, you know, do you think we should bring Richard Skinner in? And I said, well, I think, you know, he could be good for the music. So David has a conversation with him. And Richard says, yeah, I want to be seen more than just a music guy, kind of more programming and management. So David Campbell came back to me and said, look, what about you being joint program directors? And I agreed to that. And in hindsight, it was a mistake. The problem with it is it muddies the water because nobody really knows who's really calling the shots. And also DJs being DJs can play you off each other. But anyway, we get things going. We're operating out of TVAM building in Camden. The sales team had already been incorporated in Golden Square and John Pearson was the sales director. Because I think at that point, we had about 3 months to get this thing on the air. So we applied to the radio authority, who graciously gave us another month So I said to Dave, look, I'm a bit worried about this woking thing. So I go down to this radio station, which is an ILR station that John Almani had been involved with. And it was just one of those really horrible, old, fusty stations that as soon as you walked in, there was no atmosphere. The studios were right in the middle of the building, as often was the case. And I thought, there's no way that we can have a national radio station with the Virgin brand above the door here. You're not going to get big name presenters. You're certainly not going to get big name music artists. You know, you can just see Bruce Springsteen getting on the train at Waterloo, can't you, to go down to Woking. So I go back to David and I said, look, we can't have it there. It'll kill us. Got to be in London. This is a national radio station. It's Virgin Radio. Can't we put it in Golden Square where the Southsea are? Because that's fantastic there. And he came back and he said, I've got us another two floors. We're going to move the people out of the top. We're going to pay them off and blah, blah, blah. Fantastic. We were going to move the radio station into Golden Square. So I said to them, look, I want the DJs to be able to look out and they can see over Golden Square. So often, the most important part of the radio station, the bit that comes out the speaker, the people that are doing that, the presenters that are making that happen, are stuck in the bowels of a building or in the middle of a building with no windows. You know, let's give them a fantastic on-air studio. Everybody agreed, and we put the main on-air studio at the front that overlooked Golden Square, and we made that studio quite big. And there was a secondary studio which would double up as a backup on-air studio and also for production as well. And then we had the zoo area that we thought we could use for live sessions. And they also put the boardroom at the back, which is a really smart move, because when they were doing sales presentations, you know, all potential clients would come through that way and they could see the on-air studio and see the DJs and go and say hello. So that was a nice touch. We then started hiring. And I really was a big fan of Russ Williams on Capital. I used to listen to Russ. We put Russ on Breakfast to start with.
Russ Williams. Bonjour, 7:45.
One of the things I decided on, Selektra had just brought out a piece of kit which was called Master Control. And nobody was really using it in the UK. There was a small FM station called Star, who I think were in Windsor, and they were using it, but they were really using it just as an automated overnight system. But I thought, do you know what? We've got to embrace technology. So I said, well, look, let's not put all the music on it. Let's just put the ads on it, the image in, but let's belt and braces. Let's have the music on CD still. And, you know, so we had the Denon CD cart players, and we had what we called the wall of sound, the rack. That's what we decided to go with. You know, Tommy Vance couldn't quite understand why haven't we got any turntables. Where are the turntables?
1 minute and counting to the official launch of Virgin 1215.
Coming up to launch, and we were having a few hiccups with it because it was a bit glitchy. So I said to Richard Skinner, I said, look, I think we should have a little backup system here when we go live.
30 seconds and counting to the radio revolution.
I think we should get some mini disc players, put the ads on it and put the idents on it and put the jingles on it and the sweepers, just so belt and braces. You never know, do you? It could crash.
Hello to everyone here in Manchester and across the UK. It's 12:15 on Friday, April 30th, 1993. A date which will go down, we hope, in broadcasting history.
We go on air at 12:15. Master Control fell over about 12:28.
Virgin 12:15. We were launched officially just 27 minutes ago by the boss, Richard Branson, at the Virgin Megastore in Oxford Street, Manchester. And with Richard all day today is our breakfast jock, Russ Williams. Russ.
The first day, it was really interesting because there was a lot going on. We had Russ out on the road with Branson in a helicopter flying around to various Virgin megastores, film crews everywhere, tripping over cables and everything else. I mean, it was a very exciting time and a very exciting time in my life, and I couldn't quite believe that I'd actually, A, landed the gig as program director or joint program director of Virgin Radio, you know, the first national music rock radio station. So once we got going, I always had an issue with the music. It was too hard. It was too heavy. When we got our first Rajar, it wasn't great, and the presenters were fine. I mean, no disrespect to Russ on Breakfast. He was doing a fantastic job, and he is a brilliant presenter, but we could have done with a bit of a bigger name. I mean, we got a lot of press. You know, I'd managed to convince Chris to come in and do a show, and he was doing a Saturday morning show, the Big Red Mug Show, which was sponsored by Nescafe, which he didn't like, by the way. So he didn't like doing anything that was sponsored. Slightly ironic these days.
Okay, I am the Big Red Mug with big red hair.
But I felt two things we needed. I think we needed to refine the music policy and to calm it down a little bit. And also just to have a look at that breakfast show. So we reapplied to the Radio Authority and they let us make some changes to the music policy. And we calmed it down and softened it up a bit. You could immediately feel it sounded better. And I had John O'Coleman on in the evenings, which was the funniest thing you've ever seen. Just go and watch John O'Coleman trying to operate a desk. But John O had had a successful doubleheader show in Australia with another presenter called Dano. So I thought, well, maybe if I put Jono with Russ as a double header, it'll give Russ somebody to work off. And then they could maybe grow as a double act. You know, because it's always difficult, I think, putting people together as a double act. You know, that chemistry doesn't automatically happen. But it did, and it worked really well. And they were very successful as a double act for a very long time. And they did really well. And, you know, they picked up all sorts of Sony Awards and various other things.
Always breaking my heart, Belinda Carlisle. It's 11 minutes past 8. Russ, Jono, 4 minutes away from going in the shower with Jono. He might give us a clue who's in the shower with him. You never know.
The alien invasion. I don't know if you saw this in the
Chris's career was going through the roof because he was on The Big Breakfast. So he was really a big star then. So the fact that we had him doing a Saturday morning show for us was great, although he was a bit of a pain to deal with at that point for me, because I don't think he wanted to do it, and he didn't like the fact that he had to mention the sponsor. So that was giving me quite a lot of grief, but it really did help us with the launch of the station, because it helped us get a lot of press because of his stature. You know, we were great friends and we'd get together, and he said to me, we're going to do a big New Year's Eve program. He said, can you come up with some ideas for it? So I went away, came up, wrote down a load of ideas. So one of the ideas I pitched to him was, I said, look, why don't you do it? Let's do it in front of a live audience, but get the audience to bring their suitcases and their passports with them and run a competition. And whoever wins the competition has to go on holiday to this amazing holiday straight away. They have to go. And he didn't even bat an eyelid. And I thought, oh, well, he didn't like that. Fast forward a bit, I get a phone call from a guy called Chris Tickier, who's at Freud's Communications. So Freud's used to do all the PR for Virgin Radio, but also they did all Chris's personal PR. And Chris Tickier said to me, there's going to be a story about you in The Sun tomorrow. And I went, well, what do you mean? He said, no, it's not a bad story. It's a good story. I get in the next morning, front page of The Sun, Evans pays Pale £200,000, a fortune, whatever it is, for format idea to toothbrush. And I hadn't spoken to Chris. Literally, the phone rings. I pick it up and he's laughing at the end of the phone. He said, what do you think? He said, I love that idea, but I didn't tell you at the time. And he said, and when I pitched Don't Forget Your Toothbrush to Michael Grade, the bit that he really liked was your bit. So I've got to pay you.
Don't Forget Your Toothbrush welcomes you to the wonderful fantasy world of Mr. Christopher Evans.
But what was interesting during that period, and I don't know why, but David Campbell seemed to take umbrage with the fact that I got paid quite a lot of money for Don't Forget Your Toothbrush. And something changed. Something changed with him and the dynamic in our relationship. He's a brilliant person and he's brilliant at running business. And he wants everything and he wants it now. And if things are not happening fast enough for him, you know, he could be really forceful. He certainly changed in his attitude towards me. And there was this woman turned up on the scene, Susie, I can't remember her other name, she was an American program director. And then Virgin had won the FM license for London. And David said to me, I think it'd be a good idea that if Susie came in and took over programming and you went and set up the FM side for London. And I said, well, why would you want to do that? He said, well, I think it'd just be a good idea. I think she'd be a really good PD. I said, you know, why? She's not going to come in and incentivise everybody. She doesn't know any of the UK presenters if we want to make changes. You know, I had a massive black book and it's one of the things I did from a very early age. He wouldn't have it and he kind of forced me into this sideways move.
From the 10th of April, the talking stops and the music starts. Virgin 105.8 FM.
From there on, the relationship became pretty toxic and I wasn't happy at all. And I got the sense he was trying to edge me out. And like all radio stations, there's a lot of politics going on. And it was at this time that Matthew Bannister had taken over Radio 1. The ratings for Virgin were doing great because Radio 1 were losing listeners hand over fist and we were picking them up. And David and I, our relationship continued to deteriorate really to the point where he didn't want me around. And I get a call from Chris and he says, Matthew Bannister's phoned me, wants me to do the breakfast show at Radio 1. He said, well, would you come and produce it? And I said, well, I said, the problem is, Chris, if you haven't got control, Steve Wright was doing it and, you know, it didn't work. I said, if you haven't got control, it ain't going to work. I said, because I think they've got a problem with their music policy. At the time, their music policy was a bit of a mishmash. I think they were through that transitional period of what Radio 1 was and what GLR was. There was some kind of hybrid and it just wasn't working. So he said, well, what if I say to Matthew, we want to do it as an independent production? And I said, well, he's never going to agree to that. That is, it's their flagship show. They're never. He said, he hasn't got any choice. You know, if he wants me, that's what they got to do. Calls me back an hour later. Yeah, he's agreed to it. I said, that's amazing. He said, so let's do it. So I said, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I knew Matthew very well and knew Trevor, you know, and I like Matthew very much. I've got a lot of respect for Matthew Bannister. So we set up a company, Chris and I, it was called Ginger Air. We set off to produce the show. So Holly Samos was my PA at Virgin Radio. But we already knew Holly from GLR days, and she used to work with Chris at GLR, and that's why I engaged her as my PA at Virgin. And I said to Chris, look, can I bring Holly? And he said, yeah, of course. So I got Holly to come over. And he said, I'm bringing Dan McGrath. And I knew Dan. Dan was head of sound at the Big Breakfast, but he'd done some radio with Chris. He'd been on some GLR shows and the Red Mug show on the Saturday morning at Virgin. He was on there as well. So we go to Egdon House at Radio 1. And as I walked in, I thought, only whatever it was, 15 years ago, I was sitting on those steps as an apprentice joiner, looking at Diddy David Hamilton and Ed Stewart coming out. We set up inside Egdon House. It would be fair to say we weren't very popular from the get-go. It was a bit of an us and them mentality because they still had a bit of the old guard in there. Some of the old school producers were in there. They really didn't like us. We set up offices there. Initially, we were down in the basement, which was the old record library or the Graham Library, as the BBC liked to call it. So we then move up onto the upper floor. We get going and we're on the air.
I've been practicing for this job for the last 20 years, that's what I say. Yes, it's my show, I'm here now. It's BBC Radio 1, and we're on the air.
We have a self-op studio, because, you know, the main on-air studios at the BBC, certainly Radio 1, they have a studio manager and one side with a desk, and then you're at your own desk. We didn't want that. I was the producer. Dan and Holly were on air with Chris. And I was the other side of the glass. And I had no inclination to be on air. I preferred the process of making the programmes. And we have a bit of argy-bargy with them over the music policy. So Jeff Smith said of music, and Jeff's a sweetheart, as we all know. I think Trevor was kind of manipulating the music from behind the scenes. And I wanted to make some changes to music, and they weren't happy about it. But they kind of agreed, and I think it suited our show more. And, you know, I said, look, it's quite simple. We've got to nick the listeners back from Virgin Radio. That's where they've gone. They've all gone to Virgin Radio. We need to steal them back. So they agreed to that, and we immediately start to have an impact. So the first radar, bang, we've stopped the rot. Listeners are coming back.
If we tune in to the public long enough and often enough, we'll realise that we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing by the kind of listeners who
so come on the air. I'm producing, the kind of and I'd be walking in and out from, you know, the control room into the on-air studio. And so while the records were playing, I'd be saying things to Chris and he would go, that's really funny, say it on the air, say it on the air. So I would then start saying stuff on the air. So then it kind of evolved into me spending more time on the air, and then I became Johnny Boy, and I became this character or this sidekick. And Dan took over production role, so Dan then became the producer, and I became the executive producer because I would have to deal with Matthew, because it was a time when Chris was particularly difficult as an individual. I mean, he's always been an immensely strong character, and he's never changed from the day I first met him, he's always been that strong, dominant character. And I remember the first time I met him, I went home and I said, I've met somebody today and I've never quite met anybody like him. And I think he's going to be a massive star. Born to be wild. So Chris was incredibly difficult. Born to be wild. So I was in and out of Matthew's office. You know, it was just easier to take the door off because I was in and out so many times. You know, and poor Matthew was tearing his hair out. And there was so many things, and we weren't very popular. We were up on this top office floor, and there's a flagpole. We had a balcony that you could walk around the top of Egton House, and there was a flagpole. And he saw this flagpole, and he said, get a flag made of the Ginger logo. And the Ginger logo was a pair of specs. So I got my PA to get this flag made, and it duly arrives, and we open it. And there's this great big flag, and it's like 3 metres by 5 metres. Huge, great big black flag with orange spectacles on it. We put it onto this flagpole and we get out, and we're chuffed to bits with this. And then I hear my PA on the phone going, yes, you need to speak with John. 1 second, I put him on. So I get on the phone, say, hello. I said, who are you? He said, I am the manager of BBC Properties, and it's come to our attention that you have a flag flying outside Egton House, and subject to BBC regulations, you know, XYZ, that's illegal. You're going to have to take it down. And it got to the point, so we refused to take the flag down, and it became Flaggate. And of course, Chris is on the air the next day, and this is going mad. So the newspapers are there, the Sun around there, we've got photographers outside taking photos. They're all writing about it. After about day four, Matthew said to me, John, please take the flag down. It's gone as far as John Burt. So I said to Chris, look, we've had 4 days run at it. You know, we've been in the papers every day. Let's take the flag down because, you know, Matthew's getting a lot of grief and it's really coming from upstairs. And that is what he was brilliant at, and understanding how to manipulate all of those things. Radio 1. We came off air one day and he said, let's go and have a cup of coffee. And we walked up to Regent's Park, a lovely summer's day, and we're sitting there. He said, I want to go back on the television. So he said, I've got an idea. And he said, it's called TFI Friday. I said, I think it would be great if we did a music-based programme, a bit like The Tube used to be, like almost like Resurrection of The Tube. I said, probably the time to write.
OK, what is the name of the deceased?
Top of the Pops.
And I said, also the other thing, I said, I don't think it should be in the TV studio because they're quite sterile places. I said, we should find somewhere really cool, like a church or something like that, where we can... He said, yeah. So this show gets commissioned because he's hot ticket. Don't forget, Toothbrush was very successful. So we then set up Ginger Television as well then, which I'm managing director of and running this. So we start the process from, we find some offices at the Media Village down in Great Titchfield Street in London. We go there. Will McDonald came in. David Granger came in to be part of the production team. Susie Aplin came in for part of that. And we get this going. I go out to Riverside Studios with our production manager and the director. And we look at Riverside Studios, which was just like a big warehouse, effectively. And we said, this is great, isn't it? And we got our set designer, and he came in and came up with a brilliant set idea for it. So we start some rehearsals, and it's not really going anywhere. And the rehearsals were a bit clunky, and Chris was being a bit angsty. And we didn't really have a writer, and we needed to get a writer. And there was a guy called Jeff Pope, who's, you know, he was the go-to guy back then. But we couldn't get Jeff. He was just too busy. So I said to Chris, what about Danny? Let's get Danny Baker. He's a writer. So I phoned Danny up. And it was Danny that transformed the, immediately had an impact on the show and what it became. So we had this amazing live music event every Friday that when we first started, it was really interesting because you couldn't get any bands to come on. The artists and the management are quite cautious and they want to see what this thing is like. And of course, towards the end of its life, you'd have Paul McCartney phoning us up saying, can I come on? And the Rolling Stones, can I come? And you too, you know. And so I used to run all of that as I was the associate producer, but I was running Ginger Radio as it became then, and also Ginger Television. So during that period, Chris was working very hard because that TV programme does suck up a lot of your time during the week. And of course, he's getting up early doing the Radio 1 breakfast show, plus all the other shenanigans that were going on in his life. And it's well documented that he asked for Fridays off. So we left under a cloud, I think, It was a shame, really, but that's the way it worked.
The disc jockey Chris Evans is leaving Radio 1's popular breakfast show. He'd asked the BBC management to have every Friday off, but it refused and he resigned.
We then carried on with TFI Friday. We kept Dan and Holly and Jamie Broadbent, who had come in as a work experience kid, and he was fantastic. I then picked up some other work for us as an independent production company then with Talk Radio or Talk Sport, and I got Danny Baker's show. And there's a guy called Jeff Holland, who's an Australian music programmer, who was working for us as well. He'd been at Virgin Radio, and he was doing a bit of work for me on some other stuff that we were doing. And Radio Ireland had launched.
The glitzy showbiz bash was all you'd expect from the people who had given us Riverdance. Champagne flowed and streamers fell from the roof as the star lineup was revealed.
And Jeff came to me and he said, have you read this about Radio Ireland? He said, they're in a terrible state. He said, they've launched, they're getting no listeners, they're losing £250,000 a month. He said, we could go and help them. So I go over on the Saturday, meet them. They said, look, if you can come and help us, you know, it would be great. And it was a real dog's dinner, you know, DJs coming in with bags of records, you know, playing whatever they wanted. Chaos. So we wrote a plan, and we had to go and present this to the board of shareholders, of which there were about 50 of them. I walk in this room expecting to see about three or four people, and there's 50 of them. Wow. So I present this master plan, and I get a bit of a beating up on it, to be honest. So they bought into it, and then we relaunched it as Today FM. And completely revamped the whole formatting. I wasn't very popular in Ireland. I was on the front page of a lot of the tabloids. The Ginger Hatchet Man, I was known as, you know. But anyway, we turned it round, and, you know, their first book, you know, they had a 1% share, and we got them up to a 9% share pretty quick. And, you know, and they sold that for a lot of money.
Ireland has a new radio station to kick off 1998 in style.
It's very music-driven, far more so than Radio Ireland was until quite
recently. And also at that time, I'd been approached by a guy called Stephen Saltzman, who was a fairly well-known radio guy in this country. He's the son of Harry Saltzman, a James Bond producer. And Stephen used to do a programme for Capital years ago called Rock Over London. And the Next FM licence in London was up for grabs. And he said, I'm part of a consortium. He lived in Paris. He said, I'm part of a consortium that are backing a bid for this. And Michael Caine is going to be the chairman. We'd like to talk to you guys about potentially fronting this for us. And I was doing interviews in the trade press, so in Broadcast and I think in Music Week. And I'd been saying things like, we'd really like to buy our own radio station. You know, we got Radio 1 back on track. We've gone and sorted Radio Ireland out. You know, I'd really like us to have our own radio station. I go and meet these guys who want to make a bid for the London FM licence, and we put a bid together under the brand The Edge. I'm hanging out at Michael Caine's flat, smoking cigars with him, talking about radio. When you get through that process of the application process, you have to do an interview with the radio authority, a phone interview. So I'm at Michael Caine's house. So I'm trying to school him. So I'm sitting in Michael Caine's flat in Chelsea. He's on the phone to the radio authority. He would repeat the question loudly. And I would scribble the answer down on the piece of paper and hold it up. So, of course, the radio authority knew exactly what was going on, you know, because there was such a huge gap between him repeating the question really loudly and then coming back with the answer. But we didn't win that, went to XFM. So they won that, and quite rightly so. But it was during that period that Chris had been out in Ireland and just on holiday, and he'd been listening to a lot of radio, and he'd been listening to Gerry Ryan, who's a famous Irish broadcaster, and that had really got him interested back in radio. And I got a phone call out of the blue from John Pearson, who was now managing director at Virgin Radio, and he said, can we meet for a drink? Now, Virgin Radio was being sold to Capital, and I was really genuinely upset about that. And John Pearson calls me. He says, are you genuinely interested in buying a radio station? And I said, well, yeah, of course. And he said, have you got any money? And I said, well, we've got some money, you know, we had Ginger. He said, well, you could buy Virgin Radio. And I said, well, how can we do that? He said, well, Capital are outside of their period of exclusivity. But because they're so arrogant, they just feel that they don't need to renew it. And of course, John Pearson and David Campbell and the management team at Virgin didn't want capital to buy it because they would have fired them immediately. And I had a friend of mine who's a very wealthy individual and very successful in, you know, he was a corporate financer. So he I had no understanding of that world. He had all the understanding of how it worked. He said, you know, look, I can help you. He said, but, you know, they've got investors in there. Some of them might want to stay in there anyway. You know, Apex are in there. They probably want to stay in. So I then have a meeting with Chris and his agent. I said, well, look, we could potentially buy Virgin Radio. And he was like, you're joking. I said, no. And I explained the story to him. So we get the ball rolling. And the rest, as they say, is history. And we managed to buy Virgin. And off we tootle back in Golden Square, which was lovely.
I used to come in to do the show, and there'd be boxes of new computers in the hallway. And because I owned the station, I'd be thinking, do we really need those?
The reality was, you know, although Ginger bought it, Chris was the major shareholder. So for all intents and purposes, it was his. And in fact, on his business card, it said owner. The investors were keen to leave the existing management team in there. So that was John Pearson, David Campbell. So we now own this radio station and we go back into Golden Square, which was lovely to be back in there. And we go back on the breakfast show because it makes more sense, of course, that Chris comes back in to do breakfast. You know, Virgin had stalled at that point. We're back on breakfast and away we go and the ratings start to go back up again and everything's working absolutely fine.
James and Sit Down 98, it's now just gone 20 to 9. This is the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show. Our shop will be open between...
Then after a period of time... It was then deemed the time was right to sell it. There was just a consensus. There was a timing was right. It was one of those things, and it is all about timing. So those machinations were put in place to get the ball rolling. SMG came into it. They swept up the whole group, and they paid a lot of money for it. I knew that Chris would be really unhappy. SMG were very different animals to us and to Virgin. They were essentially a bunch of accountants. And suddenly the whole dynamic within the radio station changed. You'd have men walking about in suits, lots of men walking about in suits. And as nice as they are, you know, on the surface, they weren't Virgin and they certainly weren't Ginger. That was going to cause a problem. And things started to fall apart pretty quickly. I was doing my own show. I had the Wheels of Steel because, this thing all started. The Wheels of Steel thing started as a bit of a joke on TFI Friday. Just one day, we were in the studio waiting for Chris to come in, and the XD line lit up, and it was his agent saying, yeah, Chris won't be coming in today, he's not very well. I'll give you a call when he's okay. So I try and phone Chris, and Chris sometimes would have a mobile phone and sometimes he wouldn't, or I'd phone him at home, and so I couldn't get a hold of him. So I then present the show, and we carry on, and then, of course, all the management are arriving and they're coming up. What's going on? Where is he? Oh, I don't know, he's sick. Well, of course, he's not sick. You know, he's being filmed down at the pub with Billy Piper or whoever he happened to be with at the time. Next day, he phones in, sick. Well, he's not because, he's, you know, and so all this starts... I know him so well. You know, I can just see how it's all about to unfold. He wasn't happy, and he came back, and then he runs off to Las Vegas to marry Billy Piper. So we're holding the fort. I'm presenting the show with, you know, Dan and Holly and Jamie. And there's all of these things going on in the background. So Chris is saying to the management, I don't think I want to work with John or Holly or Dan anymore. And I see that the management are going, well, we'll get rid of them. Don't worry about that. We'll get rid of them. And, you know, you can do what you like. Because they were so desperate to cling on to him. So whilst he's out in Las Vegas getting married, he phones me at home and says, look, it's run its course. I don't think we should work together anymore. And I said, okay, well, it's fair enough. It's a shame. And I said, you need to phone Dan and Holly. I said, I'm not telling them. You need to tell them that. If you don't want to work with Dan and Holly, you need to tell them that. Which he did. And then about a week later, he comes back on the air at Virgin Radio with a new breakfast show team. And he makes no reference about us whatsoever. I was still going in to do the Wheels of Steel, so I would go in on a Thursday to record it. John Hipper, who's my producer, would just give me a stack of emails from listeners that were all addressed to the breakfast show saying, what's going on? It meant nothing to him that we'd been with him throughout that really important period in breakfast radio in the UK, where I think we really turned breakfast radio on its head. You know, from then in, it's often been copied and emulated. But we were genuinely friends, good friends, and that's what gave it its spark and its chemistry. and it lagged on for about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then he started playing up again, and Paul Jackson got into a position where he had no choice but he had to fire him, and that's what he did.
In Soho, the head of Virgin Radio, and listen to a statement from station executives there.
I can confirm on behalf of Virgin Radio that Chris Evans is no longer a presenter at the station. He has been in breach of his contract and we were left with no...
So throughout all this, because he's broken his contract and they fired him, a lot of the money that he would have got for that was in shares. So he got a lot of cash, but the bulk of it was in shares. And SMG weren't going to give him those shares because he'd broken his contract. Obviously, they've got some very heavyweight legal people looking at this, and they've been advised. For whatever reason in Chris's head, and he was taking legal advice, he thought he was in the right. So I was getting calls constantly from both legal teams, from SMG's side and from Chris's side. And I didn't want to get involved. And I said to them, this is nothing to do with me. I don't want to get involved in any of this. You know, it's between you guys. People say, oh, they've settled on the steps and all these things. But for whatever reason, Chris in his own head thought he was going to win. The fact that he'd been caught on film in the pub when he's phoning in sick, he still thought he was going to win. I get a knock on the door at home one night. I open it. It's a bailiff with a subpoena. Subpoenaing me to the High Court in London to appear as a witness. Wow. So all this court case is on. It's been well documented because it's all going on. It's in the press. And so I go to the High Court, and it's number one court, the High Court of Justices. The witness box is up. You go up a little. It's like a turret. You go up a spiral staircase. So the judge was making the decision. There was no jury. This was going to be a judgment. So I'm kind of eye level with the judge. And I remember their QC was a guy called Jeffrey Voss, who then later became a High Court judge in his own right. And he was brilliant. I mean, this was like a TV show. The judge had taken an instant dislike to Chris by all accounts, from what I read in the judgment. And he kept addressing him by the wrong name for a start. So the judge came down on the side of SMG and Chris lost. You know, that was very painful for him because he thought he was in the right. And we were still talking a bit at that time, not a lot. You know, he still thinks, and I would imagine to this day, he still thinks that he was in the right and he was hard done by.
Well, there we are. As promised, that's the statement from Virgin, confirmation that Chris Evans has indeed...
Yeah, so post that, you know, we had parted company permanently. We don't have anything to do with each other anymore. And after that, I took a bit of time out. I then got involved with some live music. I had my own TV production company. I was making stuff for Discovery. I started the London Blues Festival. I co-created that with a guy called Leo Green, whose father was Benny Green, a very famous broadcaster.
Good evening, I'm Leo Green. Welcome to my bank holiday special.
And Leo's a brilliant musician in his own right, and we created the London Blues Festival, which is now in its 8th year. I sold out my shares to Live Nation. It's now owned by Live Nation. And I'm kind of just kicking back a little bit now. I think I've had my day in the radio sunshine. I'm a bit concerned that it's becoming homogenised with Global and Bauer, and I'm not sure if they're going to be the platforms to let the real radio talent come through. Where is the next Kenny Everett going to come from? Where is the next Chris Evans going to come from? Probably the BBC, if it survives. I think the bit that I look back on, but at the time I didn't really appreciate, was moving from Virgin to Radio 1 and starting Ginger. Because I do think we did change the face of breakfast radio in this country. There's no question about that. But when you're in the thick of it, you can't see the wood from the trees. You're just getting on with it. And I think now that if you go into Golden Square now, and how many radio stations are coming out of that one building? I mean, when you look back at what we had two studios. We had an on-air studio and a shoebox production studio. And you go in there now, and how many radio brands have they got coming out of that? I think that is fantastic. I do. I just hope that they give the platform and the space to the talent. Because if it's too tightly formatted, there's no breathing space. I love radio. I listen to radio all the time. I think the beauty of radio is there's an open door for anybody no matter what your background is, what your upbringing is, what your academic qualifications are. There's no barrier in radio for that. I think if you're passionate and you care about it, it's one industry that lets you in.
John Revel. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.